Hello, and welcome to the podcast, A Very Brief Introduction to the British Empire. This podcast is run by Uncomfortable Oxford, a student-led social enterprise that runs walking tours in the city of Oxford.
Our goal is to raise awareness about uncomfortable histories from the past and how they impact the modern world in Oxford and beyond.
If you're interested in learning more about our various activities, feel free to visit our website, www.uncomfortableoxford.com.
My name is Paula Larson. I am a doctoral student at the University of Oxford and co-founder and co-director of Uncomfortable Oxford. My research focuses on the legacies of colonialism within medicine and medical outcomes within Canada.
My name is Olivia Durand, and I'm also a co-founder and director of Uncomfortable Oxford. My doctoral degree at the University of Oxford is in global and imperial history, and hopefully I'm nearing the end of it. My own research centers on continental expansionism and settlement in the 19th century, especially in North America and in the Russian Empire.
My name is Vikas Mirza, and I'm the executive secretary of Uncomfortable Oxford. I'm also a doctoral candidate at the university, and I work on 20th century French and English literature. My research, more specifically, focuses on the representation of the mind in the arts, bilingualism, poetry, as well as hip-hop lyrics.
Now, the British Empire is a vast subject. It spans many centuries and multiple continents, so you will not be able to handle the entirety of its history. Hence the title, A Very Brief Introduction to the British Empire. But our lectures began running monthly back in October 2019, and we'll be releasing our podcasts on them every 2 weeks in 2020 up until the summertime. You will hear about the history of the British Empire from the beginnings in the Tudor era to the mid-1970s, more or less. So let's jump into today's podcast. This is based on a lecture that was given at the St. Aldate's Tavern in Oxford on the history of British colonization in the Atlantic Ocean. So before we jump into it, I'm just going to give Vikas and Olivia a little bit of a test. How well do you know the British Empire? How many countries could you list right now that were at some point in time part of the British Empire?
Oh, that's a difficult one because, well, the boundaries have changed quite a lot over time. So to start in North America, there's the US, there's Canada, quite a few Caribbean islands such as Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad.
Well, I'm from Pakistan, so I'm guessing quite a few countries around there are probably also countries which were controlled by the British Empire. India, for instance.
Yeah.
Many countries on the African continent, about, I think, 30% of the territory.
Yes, definitely. Do you want to hazard a guess at how many modern countries today Britain has included in their empire?
30, maybe? 40?
I'll say 60.
Yeah, definitely. So 63 modern-day countries. And that doesn't include the current 14 overseas territories that still exist as part of Britain. Just also that doesn't include the countries that were never formally part of the empire, but had been invaded by. So of all the member states today in the United Nations, there's only 22 that have never been invaded by the British. So there's a lot of the world that Britain has gone over and laid claim to in its time. And the British Empire is also not a very static, united entity. So we talk about it as if it's the empire. But many territories at one point kind of are gained, then lost, then regained, then retained over a long period of time. And each of them have different legal status within the British Empire. And they often change between the gain and loss of locations. We often hear something called the peak of the empire. And that is generally considered to be in the 1920s, actually, because Britain gained numerous territories from the First World War conflict itself. So I just want to review before we jump into the Atlantic Ocean, the different names for imperial territories so that it's kind of clear what we're talking about. So we have colonies. These are places of permanent settlement where the crown has absolute sovereignty and they have English common law as part of being a colony of Britain. Generally, they were later granted responsible government of some sort. So Canada is a really good example, but also, for instance, Jamaica and Bermuda. Then there's protectorates, a territory which is not formally annexed by Britain, but Britain has control over. It's called a protectorate because it gains British protection in return for control of its foreign affairs. yet internally it will maintain its own control over internal affairs. So the example of this would be Malta, for instance, and Cyprus. They were protected from other, usually other European nations or other empires by the British, but internally had control of their own domestic affairs. Then we have dominions, which is usually the status of a colony after it's been granted, you know, in semi-independence, so far specifically responsible government. So Canada is a dominion, for instance. So is Australia, New Zealand. Newfoundland, before it joined Canada, was a dominion as well. Mandates. This is the legal status for one country when it's transferred to the control of another by specifically the League of Nations after the First World War. So in theory, these territories were governed on behalf of the League of Nations for their benefit of the inhabitants. For example, Togoland and Palestine and Mesopotamia, historically modern-day Iraq. Those were mandates, meaning that they were given over to the British for protection or for governance on behalf of their inhabitants.
And, well, just to think about the terminology, there are not just British mandates, but also several French mandates at the end of the First World War. So Britain and France, to some extent, got to divide and control many modern-day countries across former parts of the Ottoman Empire, right?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of these terms, while they're used right now in the context of the British Empire, they're definitely not exclusive to just the British Empire. There were many European countries creating empires worldwide after the 1500s. Now, the one term that is exclusive to Britain is called the British Raj. And this refers to specifically the British dominance over the Indian Peninsula, which is modern-day India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Myanmar. So this point in time in history was called the Age of Discovery. And you still hear that term kind of thrown around. But it has changed more recently to be called the Age of Exploration. Because if you think of the term discovery, it's very problematic. It refers to Europeans going out and claiming to have discovered new worlds, of course, which they did not do. Those worlds existed for a very long time. They were lands controlled and populated by many people who had been there for a very long time. They were not discovered by Europeans in any sense of the word. So historians have recently started to call this the Age of Exploration instead. But even that term itself is quite problematic because it's, once again, very Eurocentric. Who's exploring at this time? Well, it's the Europeans. And so while we are referring to empire, we just want to problematize that concept a little bit. So at the pub, I asked the question, what's a better name for what's going on at this time in history?
A better name for the period? How about the Age of Colonization?
Age of Conquest?
Conquest, colonization.
In the case of China, for instance, the forced interaction with European powers from the middle of the 19th century is referred to as the century of humiliation. So that could be a different perspective on the idea of age of exploration.
When we gave this lecture, I remember someone suggested the age of exploitation. Because, of course, one of the main goals of empire is to exploit resources and people worldwide. So yeah, there are definitely better names for it than the Age of Exploration. Because for Europeans, they're out there exploring the world, finding things that they'd never seen before. But for the rest of the world, they have foreigners invading their country, forcing them to give up their resources, in many cases enslaving them, losing their lifeways and traditional cultures, and making them join the empire. So we just wanted to problematize that and say that there's definitely a better way of talking about this type of point in history. So, just to give you a timeline generally about where we're looking here, we're going to start in 1536 and talk about the colonization of Ireland, because most people don't think about colonization beginning within the British Isles itself. This begins in the Tudor era under Henry VIII, although there was presence there, of course, much earlier, English presence. But then it's especially solidified under Elizabeth, his daughter. And then we're going to move forward to talk about the colonization of the Americas, the Caribbean, and working our way through more or less the 16th and 1700s. 1517 is the beginning of the Reformation, and this sees a huge change in British foreign policy. The Reformation really took hold across Europe, and the unification of Europe under one religion, Catholicism, which historically it had always been, this was suddenly over. England also breaks Catholicism. In 1533, they left the church. Henry VIII established the Anglican Church with himself as his new leader, seizing incredible amounts of church, land, and wealth all over England. And this makes a big difference to what England is able to do, because it now suddenly has a ton of wealth. But also, you have a bit of a concern, because now England is no longer Catholic, yet it's surrounded by Catholics. And Henry is concerned about how much power the Catholic Church has around him. So he starts to look westward to Ireland. He decides to invade the country to bring it under the full control of England, because it was very Catholic, and partly because the earls in charge had been working with the Catholic French. There was a fear that Ireland could be used to launch attacks against England from these rival powers. And also, of course, Henry just wanted more land and wealth. So he looked towards Ireland. Now, Ireland at the time was Gaelic, with a bit of a splash of Norman and English presence. It was dominantly Catholic. It had been Christianized very early, of course. You heard of St. Patrick's Day, which is a big celebration of Irish Catholic tradition. And it had strong ties itself to the Pope. It had its own parliament and a charter of rights, much like the Magna Carta, but it was not a unified whole. Rather, it was a collection of clans and families who shared power at the time. So Henry begins by subduing the family with the most power, which is called the Fitzgerald dynasty. In theory, they were supposed to be the caretakers of English power in Ireland, but the Fitzgeralds had previously organized a few rebellions against Henry, and once he had put down that rebellion, he went about securing his power. Henry was smart about it, and he recognized the titles and lands of the native lords, so long as they submitted to him as king. And this is a key mechanism of power creation. If you can give the ruling elite that was there first the power and recognition, as long as they submit to you as king, then you'll have less resistance, more or less, because it's not like they're losing as much as they, you know, had if you completely stripped them of their titles. But that doesn't mean you're not going to threaten to strip them of their titles. So what happens is he starts a policy called surrender and regrant, meaning they will surrender first, and then he will regrant them all of their power. So he appoints a Lord Deputy and a Privy Council to oversee this area, and this creates a lot of problems. He gains power, but you can see a lot of lasting legacies from this. There is a Catholic-Protestant divide, which took the form of especially the Troubles more recently. There's the beginning of English absolute power, which again shaped that divide within the island of Ireland. And then there's this pattern that begins of first rebellion and then internal conflict.
And wasn't Ireland Britain's first settlement colony as well, with many English and then Scottish settlers going to live in Ireland? And, well, that's one of the reasons why there is such an antagonistic divide between Catholics and Protestants.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, English being Anglican and then the Catholics being the local population, that does start those early divides. And since this is what you study, do you want to, I guess, explain what settler colonialism is?
So settler colonialism is a particular type of colonialism. It is also sometimes referred to as creating white dominions, quote marks, because it entails a mass migration of families from Europe into colonized lands. And it is different from other forms of colonization that were mostly for trade purposes. In trade colonies, India, for example, there was only a very small number of foreigners, mostly working in trade and administrative jobs, and there was no demographic displacement of native populations. In settler colonies, on the other hand, individuals and later whole families undertook a long one-way voyage with the goal of settling in the land and then becoming the new, quote marks, native populations of the colonies, with several generations of settlers being born and growing up and remaining in those dominions. So the United States, or the earlier British, the 13 colonies in North America, were settler colonies. Canada was a settler colony, so were Australia and New Zealand, and to some extent, but in more complicated ways, South Africa also falls in this category. And although most of these colonies are independent countries today, there's still a lot of tensions because it is impossible to really decolonize a settler colony. since a lot of the generations of European settlers now consider the land to be the land of their own forefathers, there is a sort of double standard of belonging and nativity, and it erases the histories, the voices, and the presence of indigenous populations.
Yeah, there's a really big difference because that creates this long-term presence that really is what leads to real control over any country. So that's a big problem in Canada right now. Of course, our indigenous populations that were taken off the land through treaty process where they signed treaties. But those treaty promises were never properly honored, and the things that were promised were never properly given, but they were still able to push Indigenous peoples off their land into these reserves we created. And that is so that settlers from Europe could come in and settle. And that means that now people today think, well, this is my land. I was on that land. My parents were on that land. But they're forgetting that that land before the grandparent, before the great-grandparent, before the great-great-grandparent was land that was used by Indigenous populations. And so land itself and that concept of ownership is really intrinsic to this colonization process. So that's the beginning and the brief overview of Ireland. Now, of course, there's a more modern history that goes hand in hand with this, but we're just talking about the beginning of the empire here. And one of the first steps for empire was Ireland.
So what was happening in North America before they actually arrived there?
So before the Europeans arrived, North America was a thriving continent. It had about 7 million people, and that estimate is quite contentious because lots of people say there's 20 million. There might even be more than that. And it's really difficult for us to modern day estimate how many people were actually present in North America because of the huge decline in population over time. But I generally accepted at least 7 million people were already there. There were 10 major ethnic regions and thousands of unique tribal cultures that existed. But after Henry dies and his daughter Elizabeth later takes over, you have the beginning of colonization of North America. Now, the English in this moment were currently in conflict with the Spanish. The Spanish had already conquered many territories in Meso and South America, especially. Those were gold-rich territories. They conquered the Inca, the Aztec, the Mayan people, and subjugated them for generally slave extraction. So they used them to mine different materials, and there was horrific death rates in the Spanish slave areas. But the English then began to harass and loot Spanish boats that had been transporting these valuable gold-rich resources back from South America. The English thought, okay, this is very wealthy. Clearly, there's lots of good stuff to get in the Americas. We need to have a peace as well. So under Elizabeth, men like John Cabot, John Smith, Walter Raleigh began exhibitions for finding territories that the English could then claim as their own. British ships arrive and they start establishing some fishing colonies in what is modern-day Newfoundland and on the east coast of Canada. And they begin a process of this colonization, this permanent settlement, settler colonies on the east coast of North America, starting in the early 1600s. So, quiz. What are the original 13 colonies of the United States of America?
Virginia, Pennsylvania, state of New York, Massachusetts, New Hampshire.
Doing well, guys.
New Jersey, the Carolinas.
Yeah, later divided.
Georgia.
Connecticut.
Maryland.
Connecticut, nice.
It was Maryland. No, Maryland is later, I think. Or did it exist already?
You got Maryland.
Okay, Maryland existed as a thing.
It still does, in fact. Still a thing.
Rhode Island. Yeah. And
I mean, I feel like this is very unfair towards other people who are not all historians. Deep students in settler colonialism.
Well,
I don't even study that bit.
Well, you do study America, so to be fair. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, basically the first 13 colonies, you did really well, much better than the group of people at the pub did, too, because I think they got, like, 5. But also, I'll give you the pass on the original names, too, of course. So all the East Coast, basically. And those were not just the only colonies because Canada was part of the settlement, too. Well, we think of it as the United States of America. Actually, this was just British Americas. We have Canada East, Canada West, Newfoundland, and Acadia.
Yes, but there was not just British America. There was also a strong French presence as well in the Canadian parts at that point in 1762.
Exactly. So there was definitely a French presence, especially in northern North America, which is modern-day Canada. And that's why Canada today speaks, of course, English and French, because the French were there as well, especially in fur trade.
Yeah, all the fur trappers.
So this is very different from the whole Christopher Columbus discovers the Americas narrative.
Yes. So the traditional jingle that everybody hears in America is in 1492, Columbus sails the ocean blue. But, well, first of all, he was never actually in America, or at least the modern day territories of it. And this story is not some celebratory, wonderful little story about Europeans going abroad and creating their lovely little colonies. It's the story of the 7 million people who are already on the North American continent. It's the story of especially smallpox. There is incredible devastation when the British arrive. So in 1986, Alfred Crosby came up with the idea of the virgin soil thesis. If you want more details about that specifically, we did talk about it in our first podcast on disease and empire. And it's seeking to answer the question, why did so many indigenous people die when the Europeans arrived? Because warfare and later subjugation was part of it, but the most substantial factor in place was disease, especially smallpox. And the theory is that Europeans living in Europe at this time had had a number of endemic diseases. Endemic meaning diseases which you basically get in childhood that are not so intense and you usually survive through, such as, like, for instance, chickenpox. We've all had chickenpox here or had the vaccine for it, assumably. Have you all had chickenpox?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Pretty much.
So it's not all that bad of a disease if you get chickenpox in childhood. Children tend to experience, like, a milder version anyway, and that spreads amongst other children, but not any further because everybody else has already had it, so they're immune. But what happens is when the Europeans arrive with smallpox, which was an endemic disease in Europe, I mean, it was definitely there, but it wasn't nearly as devastating before contact. But Europe had a number of milder pox-like diseases that existed as part of their childhood diseases at this time. And suddenly, those diseases reach a population which has never had immunity in it. And that lets the disease spread. And while it may start off as this fairly mild childhood disease, when it reaches this adult population, suddenly it's not stopped by like a herd immunity of any sort.
So basically, it spreads to an adult population that has never had those diseases in childhood. And I guess it's the same as when you have someone today who has never had chickenpox as a child. It's very dangerous for them to get it as an adult.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, but the longer a disease can spread, the more it evolves into a more deadly disease too, the more virulence it has. And that leads to this huge devastation of the indigenous community. So North America, which has about 7 million people, through this process, the population declines to barely 200,000 people. So it's a huge decline in population.
And how many years, how fast did this decline go?
It's about the course of the first century, so it's not like right away. But as the Europeans arrive, the disease spreads a lot faster than the people do. So that actually tends to be one of the reasons why we have trouble with figuring out how many people were there first, because if the disease came to a community, then people would see the presence of disease and they would flee to other areas, and then that disease would travel with them. And the Europeans, while they settled on the East Coast, never saw the devastation that happened inland, although they all knew that this was a really big problem. There's definitely cases of English general specifically, you know, giving a smallpox blanket, or at least ordering smallpox to be given to indigenous communities during the tensions that happened. So they were well aware that they were bringing it. And then the virulence of smallpox increases because of this new population and the ability for it to spread and become more deadly. And then it starts to reinfect Europeans who should have previously been immune to it too. So smallpox as a disease gets far more deadly because of this process. But it's not the only thing that affects the population decline. We also have slavery. The first forms of slavery were called indentured servitude, meaning that an individual was indentured, so enslaved more or less, for 7 years. Now, this form of slavery was one of the original types that existed in North America, especially for the indigenous and some African people brought over by the Europeans, but also some of those Irish people that were especially political prisoners from the colonization of Ireland.
Also, some English people decided to become indentured servants because the contract they signed also included the transportation fee across the Atlantic, as well as some amount of food, clothing, and shelter.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the original form that it existed in the 1600s, early 1600s here. The type of slavery that we often think of when we think about slavery developed as time went on. So the enslavement based specifically on race. So John Punch is the very first black slave that existed in America in Jamestown in 1660s. And of course, the British were not the only Europeans that were creating systems of slavery.
Yes, slavery was present from very early on in the Spanish and Portuguese empires. Although initially, Central and South America had a much, much larger indigenous population than North America. So at first, they enslaved massively indigenous Americans. But because of the rapid spread of epidemics, these populations were also on the decline. But there was also an ideological shift when this very famous controversy happened in Spain amongst members of the Catholic Church, so in the 1550s, and it's called the Valladolid debate. It was a moral and theological debate about the conquest of the Americas, its justification for the conversion to Catholicism, and more specifically about the relations between the European settlers and the natives of the so-called New World. And one of the debaters, the Bishop Bartolomé de las Casas, tried to prove that indigenous people had a soul, and if it was proven that they did have a soul, that would make it very much more problematic to enslave them because they were free men. At the end of the debate, both sides claimed to have won, but ultimately the treatment of the Native Americans was somewhat improved because conversion to Christianity, to Catholicism, ensured that some of their rights would be respected, although their populations were already on the decline. However, it had the consequence to accelerate the trade of slaves across the Atlantic from the African continent to Central and South America, and later to North America.
So this is really the beginning of enslavement based on race.
So Olivia mentioned these controversies around Christianization. Paula, could you tell us a little bit more about them?
Absolutely. As Olivia just mentioned too, the idea that you had to Christianize, or you could Christianize, the indigenous population was a really big part of how the Europeans gained control across a lot of these territories. So indigenous cultures were usually evacuated from their traditional lands because there was no recognition that those were traditional lands in any way. And they were often put onto what were forms of like Christian colony communities. So they were indentured in those communities where they would work the land. They would be part of a mission society of some sort, kind of like a self-contained community that would create its own food and work on Christianizing, but also in later terms that extended to the development of schools that were supposed to be Christianizing them. And the idea was that it was a moral imperative of Europeans, that they had a moral duty to Christianize as well as civilize these communities. And that meant to get rid of the cultures that were already there, to stamp out what were considered heathen cultures. And the loss of traditional life ways is a big part of that.
And I guess there was a big imperative also in terms of conversion when you get the wider picture of different European empires competing in North and Central America, because you have Spain that's mostly Catholic and Britain that has recently become Anglican. So in addition to the territorial tensions between the two empires, British, Spanish, the attention in terms of land grab. They tried to use conversion as well as a way to get the allegiance or the loyalty of different Native American nations.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, the missionaries themselves were a really big part of the political tensions between European powers, but then also creating alliances with different, especially Iroquois cultures, with the French and English.
I've often heard of the label West Indies. What was happening around that area at the time?
Yeah, so we've covered Ireland, we've covered North America. So let's jump into the Caribbean, which is called historically the British West Indies. Now, most people tend to think of British colonization of the Americas in terms of the large continent that exists, so modern-day United States and Canada. But actually, the largest early settlements were not in those areas, but were instead on the island nations which make up the territories of the former British West Indies.
Why are they called West Indies?
That is because, of course, they were not the East Indies that existed where, you know, India was in the East. The original justification for exploration westward was to find a new route to China that would be shorter, because they thought, well, there was nothing there. And then they found that they were in North America when they landed, and that's why Native peoples were called Indians, and British West Indies were called the West Indies. So this belief that they were actually in India before they even realized that this large piece of land existed. The territories that make up the former British West Indies would be including Bermuda, the Bahamas, Barbados, Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaica, British Honduras, British Guyana, part of modern-day Nicaragua, as well as numerous smaller islands, some of which today are still held as foreign territories of the United Kingdom, such as the Leeward and Windward Islands. Settlement in the Caribbean began in 1625, and by 1650, there were over 44,000 English settlers in the region. So compare this to only 12,000 in Virginia. So much higher amount of community had settled in the Caribbean. And many of those were originally transported as indentured servants, who would be indentured for 7 years, as you said, to pay their fee, and then they would get their freedom and be rewarded with land to establish their own plantation. And so this is an interesting change here. So indentured servitude meant there was an end to it. You were indentured, but for a certain amount of time, usually 7 years. This is not the case when it comes to other forms of slavery.
So what happens on these different plantations?
So a plantation is a cash crop production house. Basically, one crop that requires a large amount of land to be harvested. It's very labor intensive. And cash crops often are tobacco, cotton, sugar, indigo, the color, the dye itself originally. Those were all kind of cash crops. And sugar had originally been the mainstay for the Caribbean plantation lifestyle. In fact, sugar really transformed the island nations. By 1660, the population of white Europeans was about equal to the population of the African slaves that were imported for this labor. Now, the importation came from Africa, and this is a really important point to talk about what the slave trade did to Africa in a very generalized term, because what's quite often said, so whenever we have a talk, people say, oh, but slavery existed first in Africa. You know, the Europeans didn't invent slavery. Well, that's true. They didn't invent slavery. Slavery has been around for a very long time as a practice. Even the Romans, of course, took slaves. But what they did was they invented racialized slavery. And that is the beginning of modern racism, the way we have it today, which is based on skin color and the idea that there was a difference between indentured servitude and the slave. Because an indentured servant could become free after 7 years, but if you were black and a slave, you could not. And that's a really big difference. And in Africa, which was a continent of very diverse peoples living in large populations all over, you had slavery that existed as part of, you know, intercity warfare. Different tribes could go to war, and then as a byproduct of conflict, they could take slaves with them. But now with the Europeans coming to the ports in West Africa, there's not just a demand for slaves, but there is a incredible pressure to get more and more slaves and to sell them to the Europeans. So you have a transformation in Africa where communities would have slavery as a byproduct of war, but now are going to war to take slaves. And that means there's greater defenses built to protect than the guns and other types of weapons that the Europeans are bringing into trade become really important because it protects your city from being raided for slaves. And then you have this transformation of across many different communities that had previously always been different but hadn't consistently gone to war to take more and more slaves to feed this never-ending hunger for slaves that the Europeans brought to Africa. And then they would take those slaves on ships across the Atlantic Ocean to work on these sugar plantations. And then the sugar, which would be taken from North America, from the Caribbean, would be brought into Europe, into especially England. And then manufactured goods would go down to Africa. And it creates this triangular trade that's often referred to as the Columbian Exchange.
In the 16th century, Britain also got the asiento, which is the monopoly on the slave trade in the Atlantic Ocean, or at least the monopoly on the slave trade towards the numerous Spanish colonies. And Britain kept the asiento from 1713 to the 1740s. And in just 30 years, they shipped about 500,000 slaves across the Atlantic.
Yeah, Britain is often remembered as the great abolitionist nation because they were the first to abolish the slave trade. But what's often forgotten is that out of all the European nations, Britain was one of the ones that transported the most slaves across the Atlantic, second only to Portugal. And this is a fact that's often forgotten in these conversations. So the population in the Caribbean, which as you said was 44,000 English settlers by 1650, there was a bit of a decline as some of the originally settled settlers moved northward. Those indentured servants were given freedom. Then they moved northward to get their own plantations. And the population of Europeans in 1660 was about equal with African slaves, about 27,000 slaves to 26,000 white Europeans. But within 40 years, the number of slaves through this trade was far greater. So you have only 15,000 white Europeans to 50,000 African slaves. And that tells you that this is a huge trade that's going on. And as you said, Britain is not just selling slaves into its own colonies. It's also selling slaves into all the other European ports, especially to the Spanish, where they have a monopoly on the slave trade. So this type of trade itself is based on the system of mercantilism, which is an economic system that brought great wealth to England and later to Britain. So mercantilism is where most of the trade occurs, of course, over the oceans and the trading from ports to ports. And this led to a huge economic gain, not just Britain, because once that money comes in, people could gain from this system without actually being slave traders. The money from slavery went over into the colonies, and then the goods from the colonies came into England, into other locations. And that wealth generates this huge income, which today you can see in the building of many of our beautiful buildings across the UK, especially at Oxford here, from just wealth that was generated from this type of trade. And that the fact that we think of it as isolated is actually just is incorrect. A lot of this wealth and the wealth that we still enjoy today came from the trade in people that happened across the Atlantic Ocean. So that's the end of this early introduction. We only went up to the year 1700, and again, a very basic introduction to the British Empire. This empire itself is such a vast subject. It spans so much of history and many continents. But this is hopefully a good introduction to the first steps towards the empire.
Yeah, and I guess this kind of leaves us with a number of questions to reflect upon, right? Like mm-hmm. the benefits that Britain gained from having these colonies, the impact that it had on different indigenous people, and also the impact that it had on other parts of the world, for instance, Africa.
Yes, concluding question is also what impact this very early colonization has on Britain or Western Europe today, and how we can see legacies of this past in the buildings, in the things we eat, and the things we're used to see in our daily lives in the 21st century.
And just the modern conflicts that are currently happening, the tensions we feel today. I mean, in Canada, there's tons of tensions over the lack of honoring treaty promises to Indigenous populations, the current intergenerational trauma of that Christianization and civilization, I say with quotations, process that damaged and brought many people into these consistent cycles of poverty and disenfranchisement and, you know, just general misery.
And still in the Caribbean, we can see an uneasy relationship between Britain and different Caribbean islands, and how people coming to Britain from Jamaica, from other Caribbean islands that were formerly controlled or are still controlled by Britain, how they're treated today.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, the legacy of slavery itself, too. I mean, Britain began it in America, and it stuck around even after America became independent. So that has led to, of course, racial tensions that you still see today as well.
In the next podcast, we'll be looking at early British colonization in the Indian Ocean. So for these talks, we decided to go along oceanic units to try to show how those processes were happening in a very connected way, and were involving lots of different populations, and were more than just a one-way route from Britain into specific locations.
For those who want to attend the lectures as well, you're welcome to join us. They take place on the first Thursday of every month in different locations across Oxford, which are all listed on our website. Of course, currently due to coronavirus restrictions, we have decided to postpone the lectures for the time being.
Our website is www.uncomfortableoxford.com. And if you want to join in some of these conversations, you can also join us on one of our uncomfortable tours, where we walk around Oxford and we show you the different buildings, statues, memorials that are in place as legacies of empire. So we have many different tours that run weekly, and we hope to see you there.
This podcast was made possible through support from Torch, the Oxford Research Centre in the Humanities. The music you heard is Wishful Thinking by Dan Leibowitz.